We are starting our Binyan HaBayit class. We started last week, and we will be continuing. The story is told. Our subject tonight is going to be a few things. We're going to try to focus on enemy number one of the engagement period in marriage, and we are going to try to discuss faith in one another, and prenuptials, and division of assets, how we work out money issues, and discussion of divorce within a family. Those are our topics for tonight. I hope we get to cover all of them. So the story is told that a guy was engaged to be married, and he was jittery. He was a nervous guy. And he kept asking himself, is this the right girl, is this the right girl, is this the right girl? Which, by the way, is totally normal. Whenever someone tells me they got engaged, the first thing I tell them is, Mazel Tov, do you regret it yet? So they look at me like, no, come on. So I say, okay, you don't regret it, but have you begun to doubt it yet? And automatically they get defensive, no. You know that no? You know that no that says yes? So you get that no, and I tell them, okay, so you will. Don't worry about it. Have faith. You'll get there. Everyone, when they get engaged, start doubting their decision. The question is, do they doubt it a minute after they got engaged? Do they doubt it a minute after and 10 minutes after? Do they doubt it a week later, a month later? Do they doubt it when they're standing under the altar, under the chuppah? There are different stages of doubt, and different people react different ways. But everyone goes through this phase of levels of doubt between engagement and marriage. So this guy is jittery, and he's more jittery than after the average guy. And he's standing under the chuppah, and Rav Chaim from Brisk is the rabbi who's ordaining the chuppah. And he takes the ring, and he's about to start engaging her, and he's shaking, and the ring falls. So he turns to his rabbi, and he says, you see, it's not supposed to happen? So his rabbi, who's very, very smart, he said, no. In heaven, there's a specific second when you were supposed to engage her. It didn't come yet. Now pick it up. Now's the second. Now engage her. Now you'll see it'll work. And that's what happened. And the guy got married, and they lived happily ever after. But this doubt, is this Mrs. Wright? This doubt plagues everyone. There was a guy who shared with me the following story. He kept thinking, this is Mrs. Wright, this is Mrs. Wright. And then got to the wedding. He's happy and he's arranging everything. And he's standing under the chuppah. And the kala starts coming towards the chuppah. And she's there at the end of the aisle. And he looks out at her. He looks down at the floor and he says, what am I doing here? So he starts thinking. Now his mind is racing. The kala is moving and everyone's singing. And he's thinking. He's thinking to himself, gee, nothing happened yet halachically. I could walk out of here and just say, guys, it's over. No, it's not happening. And then she could just remarry. It's like a broken engagement. Nothing happened yet. Right. So and he thinks to himself, gee, this really isn't right. How'd I get here? What, me marrying her? Wait a second. Hold it. She's walking and he wants to tell her, wait, let me think. She's walking and he's thinking and he says, look, it's not right. I don't think I should be marrying her. How could I go through with this? And she's coming towards the steps and he thinks, and in a flash, he's reminded, he remembers how there were two women in our history. One was dying to marry Yaakov Avinu. Her name was Rachel. And when the night of the wedding came, her father said, nope, you're not going in. And he sticks in Leah. And then she says, yeah, but Yaakov's going to figure it out. So she tells Leah the secret sign that she had made up with Yaakov so that Leah could trick Yaakov. Yaakov was worried that there would be a switch. So Yaakov made up with Rachel a secret sign. And that secret sign was, what are the three mitzvahs of a woman? Rashi tevos chana, chala nida ad lokas aner. So Rachel quickly tells Leah, wait, let me teach you. There are three mitzvahs a Jewish woman has, chala nida ad lokas aner. Yaakov's going to ask you that under the chuppah to make sure you're me. Tell him that and he'll know you're me. So Why'd she do that? Because she didn't want to embarrass her sister Leah. And in that merit, she was able to stand up for the Jewish people for eternity. When no one else could stand up for us, she could stand up. That's why the Jews were exiled. They passed by Kever Rachel, and she was able to walk before God and plead on behalf of the Jewish people. Why? Because she said, I let my sister take my place. I wouldn't embarrass her. I let her marry Yaakov. So this guy is thinking, wow, for generations we got it because she wouldn't embarrass Leah. I'm not going to embarrass her, he decides. I'm not going to do this to her. God is going to make this work, and I'll make it work. And he decides, that's it, I'm marrying her. And he steps forward, puts a huge smile on his face, and greets his Kala. And after the wedding, the way he told it to me, when they walked out of Cheder Yichud, he kicked himself. He said, what's wrong with me? What came over me that minute? I wanted to marry her. I dated her. I loved her. I'm thrilled I married her. Why did I have those seconds where I was sure this was a mistake? And the answer is pressure. Like in the engagement period, it's pressure. But after the engagement period, when you're married, it's not pressure. It's life. And the most natural thing that happens after a couple gets married is that they both think, boy, was this a mistake. This was wrong. That's the most natural thing. Now, you guys are laughing. I have a serious doubt as to whether this class is worth anything, because almost every week I get a phone call from someone who's married, and he tells me it was a mistake. And I say, I told you. Don't you remember the first or second class? Binyan Bayit, I told you. You're going to be married, and you're going to say it was a mistake. And the guy tells me, I know, but this was really a mistake. Guys, everyone feels that way. It's natural that when a person enters marriage, he has expectations and anticipation. And then when he's faced with reality and suddenly, wait a second, things were different when we were engaged. Suddenly he has disappointment and he's discovering who the person really is. And then a person starts asking himself the question, was she the person I was supposed to marry? Now, some people ask themselves this question and they never get married because of that, because they keep asking that question. That's one of the reasons many men never get married, because they always think, maybe there's someone out there who's better. She's good, but maybe there's better. Why should I settle for this? That's why many men never get married. It's a very, very common male ailment. But the problem is that for most men, after marriage, the question comes back to haunt them. And this is enemy number one of marriage. This is public enemy number one. That doubt, is she Mrs. Right? Now the problem is that you guys are all intelligent and from, which is a blessing. But what's the problem in that? That guys cushion their doubt with religious issues. They come and they say, you know, in heaven I was supposed to marry someone. My neshama is telling me it wasn't her. I think that there's another name up there. I got confused. So one guy calls me up last week. He says, could it be that in heavens they meant to say I'd have a bad physical year and then it became fiscal year because initially I was ill in the beginning of the year and then I had a problem with all my finances. So I told him, you know, there was a man who said that. There was Eov. He said maybe God switched the letters from Eov to Oyev. That's what the Gemara says, that at one point Eov said, maybe up there was a switch in the letters of my name. Eov is his name, Job, and Oyev means enemy. So maybe, but we say that's wrong. It doesn't happen. So what you have to know is that once you're married, she's Mrs. Right. Before you're married, you could verify and question and do whatever you want. But once you put that ring on her finger and you guys got married, she is Mrs. Right. End of story. You just discovered who they decided in heaven you should marry. And now you got to make it work. Now, I don't know how many of you were there at the Shev Brachos of Shabbos. I had a very short amount of time, but I said a point which is really very, very, very deep. I told the couple, you should know. Whatever you see in the other, you're seeing yourself. Chazal tell us this is a concept philosophically, and it's a concept that's halachic. What we see in someone else is ourself. Kol posel b'mumo posel. It's not my thought. It's a Gemara in Kiddushin. Whenever you say someone else has a fault, what you're saying is I have a fault. We only recognize in others the faults that we ourselves have. The stronger that fault is within us, the more we're able to see it in someone else. The Gemara says there was a guy who spoke after a rabbi. He said, he's a bastard. That rabbi, he's a bastard. That rabbi, he's a mamzer. He's a bastard. So the rabbi heard it, and he went to court, and he banged on the table and he says, I want everyone to know that person is a mamzer, he's a bastard. So the rabbis asked him, why'd you say that? So he said, because that's the halacha, that whoever says something, a psu, whoever says a disqualification about someone else, that means that he himself has it. So the rabbi said, really? Let's check. So they went and they started checking the yichus of this guy, and they discovered he was a bastard. He was a mamzer. Somewhere in his lineage, he really was a mamzer. And this is quoted in halacha. Now, this applies not only halachically, but also philosophically. We tend to see in others the faults that we ourselves have. And once a person starts asking the question, is this right? It's wrong. There is no marriage that could live up to that question. No marriage on earth. There was once a couple that separated. They thought they were going to get divorced. And then they came before Rabbi Feinstein and they said, we're contemplating having reconcilement. We want to have a trial to get together again. And Rabbi Feinstein said, don't bother. He said, what? Don't bother? We have so many kids. What do you mean, don't bother? So he said, don't bother making a trial. A trial is never going to work. The only way marriage can work is if you walk into that marriage and you say, this is going to work. This isn't a trial. Because the second you have a trial, imagine, let's take any two people. They sit together in a cellar for 24 hours. They're going to get on one another's nerves. If it's a trial, so what happens is, each time you say, oh, he did this. Ah, he did this too. Oh, why should I put up with this, this, and that? Come on, this is ridiculous. The list keeps getting longer and longer. Because once it's a trial, so you're checking. If you're checking, so it's never going to work. No marriage could live up to that test. That's what Rabbi Feinstein said. There's no marriage on earth that a person could live within that marriage and ask himself, should I be living here? Should I be living with her? And he's going to walk away happy. No man and no woman. No marriage could live a trial, through a trial. You could only make a marriage work when you decide this will work. This is my wife, and now we have to make it work. The stronger a person feels that this is my wife, this is my husband, and now we're going to make it work, the happier the marriage is going to be. Because then there are less issues that I could bring up. There's more to say about that, but we'll get to that. A guy calls me up. He tells me I want a shidduch. So I say, Shalom Aleichem, my name is Netanel Frankenthal, and who are you? So he tells me his name. And I ask him, what are you looking for? So he tells me, well, like everyone else, I'm looking for the best girl there is. I'm looking for the perfect girl. So I'm thinking to myself, no, I don't think that's what everyone else looks for. But he thinks everyone else is. So I tell him, okay, and what's the perfect girl? So he starts describing the perfect girl to me. So I asked him, and are you the perfect guy? So now he's stuck, he's in the corner, what's he going to say? So I said, well, you know, everyone has things they have to work on, and none of us are perfect. So we can't look for the perfect girl. And we can't think, well, my wife isn't perfect. Well, of course she's not perfect, you're not perfect. If she'd be perfect, she wouldn't be marrying you. You're marrying the person who's perfect for you. I wasn't talking to you. Everyone but you, Ephraim. Everyone but you. Happens to be, guys. You think I'm joking. But if there's someone in this classroom who's closest to perfect, it's Ephraim. You just started your count, Ephraim. No, think about it. You came out of the mikveh 4 days ago? 5 days ago? No. How many averus could you have done since then? So you're the closest to perfection. It's the truth. You're the closest guy there is here to perfection. Really, I'm not joking. Okay, now girls, if you want to know who this Ephraim guy is, give me a call. Okay, back to our Binyan HaBayit. So, in Hebrew, the word mushlam means complete, like shalim. The word mashlim means to make whole. When we're looking for a wife, we're looking for someone who is mashlim, someone who makes us whole. But that means that we're like a jigsaw puzzle. If I extend too much here, then she has to be inverted here. If she extends here, then I have to be inverted here. Pieces of a puzzle fit together where one extends, the other one goes in. So a guy comes to me and he tells me, my wife doesn't know any halacha. So I asked him, and if she knew halacha, don't you think she'd pressure you? Don't you think you'd be uncomfortable of your marriage? You just started learning two years ago? So he smiled and said, you're right. So I said, okay, so don't complain. That's why your marriage is working, because she doesn't know halacha. You can't complain about the things that are making the marriage work. Very often we take the things that within the marriage are good for us And then we look at them and we see the fault in them. That's not a fault. You want her to know more halacha, learn with her more halacha. But you wanted within your marriage a situation where you know more halacha than her, that you could teach her. Well, considering you've only been learning 2 years, then you need someone who knows much less than you. Well, that's what you got. So he agreed. He said, you're right. He was happy. And they're learning and they're both advancing in halacha. I have a friend who's scattered all over. All over. When he was in medical school, so they'd work with skulls. So he'd bring home a skull and put it on the dining room table, and then forget it there. Then a few days later, you leave a skull on your dining room table. You can imagine what's happening. So I once asked him, can't those skulls have germs on them? He said, you kidding? They could have germs that the greatest antibacterial scrub can't get off. So I said, and you're putting it on your dining room table. So he says, no, it's on the papers on the table. Okay, fine. So he marries a girl. He always said, I needed a girl who's going to be very organized, put everything in order. So he married a girl that's very organized. And then one day, he's very upset. He says, you know, she always tells me what to do. So I said, what do you mean? She tells me I have this appointment now and that appointment then, and make sure to forget to remember to take your pills in the morning and this and that. I asked him, wait a second, didn't you say you wanted that? So he said, yeah. So I said, so what's wrong? So he said, well, but she's so organized. She's rigid. I said, so what do you want? A girl that's organized but not rigid doesn't go. You take what's good and understand that part of it is going to be things that you won't enjoy so much. Fine, but that's part of who the person is. That's who you needed as a wife. So we have to know that the spouse that we're marrying is making us as a unit whole. Obviously, we're different. We're different, but we together we make a whole, and we need that. You guys know the kid who's sitting in the car and keeps asking, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" So you know what's more annoying than that? When you're sitting on a ride, and the kid keeps saying, "Is this the fun part? Is this the fun part?" Some people spend their lives asking, "Is this the fun part? Are we having fun yet? Is this the fun part?" Well, the same thing is within a marriage. You could have people who keep looking for the thrill. Is it fun yet? When we stop having these expectations, when we could start living in the here and now, yeah, this is the fun part. Some people will tell you the first year of marriage is the worst year. Other people will tell you the second year of marriage is the worst year. Other people will tell you, no, the first 2 years are bliss, everything else are the worst years. Well, guys, I have news for you. Every year could be the most beautiful year. Sometimes there are things that are tougher. The first 2 years, really, there are more things to work out. But they could still be the most beautiful years. And one of the fundamental things that we need to have in order for marriage to build is faith. Faith in one another, trust, and trust in our bond, in our relationship, in our marriage. That is fundamental to everything else. The worst thing a person can do is start laying doubt, placing doubt in the connection between the couple. The greatest thing a person can do is treat the connection as something eternal. Now, there are fluctuations. There can be days, hours, minutes when there are greater feelings of love, there is greater happiness, and then there can be minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, that there's a low. It is normal within a marriage that there are ups and downs. And it is normal that a down can last years. People think, if we're already having 3 years where I'm miserable, I'm tired of being miserable. That's not what I got married for. Well, I have news for you. That's part of marriage. There's no such thing as that's not what I got married for. Marriages have cycles, and there are moments that are beautiful, and there are years that are beautiful, and there are periods that are beautiful, but there are also moments and periods and sometimes even years that are very, very difficult. I have a good friend who they had a child born with, what's it called? Inborn serious problem. The kid's in a home. Now he's 12. The first 5 or 6 years they spent all the time with doctors and trying to make something work for the kid. And kid has a problem. It's not going to change. I mean, he has a serious issue. And now he's in a home. So they had 10 years of hell. 10 years that were really, I mean, it was a nightmare. They had other kids. And And they had this kid who was out of control, and you couldn't blame him. And there was nothing to do. It's not like you could train him differently. That's the way the kid was. There's nothing you can do. That's life. But what you can do is you could look at the situation and say, one thing is for sure. We are one. And now let's figure out how we can make the best of it. And when a couple weathers a storm, then their relationship is that much stronger. Every time a couple is having difficulties, that's an opportunity for the bonds to become stronger. Now, difficulties don't have to be external. Difficulties could be internal. It is most fundamental to give one another the feeling that this relationship is eternal. And here comes the question that people ask a lot about prenuptials. Everyone know what prenuptials are? No. Okay, so it used to be many, many years ago, and it's returning now, that there would be an agreement written before a couple got married. If they would get divorced, how would the assets be divided? Now, that's one form of prenuptial. Then there's another aspect that is being added lately by some people, and that is that if the wife will want a get, then the husband will agree to go to a court, A, B, and C, to adjudicate the matter, and he won't detain and withhold the get. And if he does, then some say you're allowed to put in a clause that he'll get a fine of such and such money if he does, etc. And that's a big halachic discussion whether it's permissible altogether to do such a thing. Yeah?
In all technicalities, isn't a kesuba a prenuptial?
Not exactly, because... okay, I guess you could say kesuba is a prenuptial, but the idea of prenuptials is that that you want to add more details. Now, I'm not going into the halachic question. I just want to mention a point. Some people have a very hard time jumping into marriage with both feet. It's like the guys who stand there, you ever go swimming and there's a high diving board? So there are those people who, by the time they get up there, they walk to the front, they lean over and they look, they walk back and they lean over and they look, and then they stand there and they hesitate back and forth, and the whole line is waiting, and they're looking at, do I go? And then they walk back down. In marriage, you got to jump. When you jump, there's no leaving one foot on the diving board. You're jumping in with both feet. And that's the only way you could get married. And that pertains to everything. If we're getting married, that means I trust you. Now, before you get married, don't trust. I was once dating a girl, and she asked me, do you trust me? I said, no. She said, why not? I said, because right now we're dating. When we're dating, I have to verify. If I'll choose to marry you, then I'll trust you, because I will trust you with everything. If I marry you, right now I can't trust you with anything. I have to verify everything. I'm checking everything out. After I check out, how do I know you're not telling me a line? So everything you tell me, I try to verify. After I verify that you're a truthful person, then when I'll marry you, then if I'll marry you, I didn't end up marrying her, but if I'll marry you, then because I'm going to put all my faith in you, that's why I have to verify everything in advance. Once you're married, then everything, we're one. We're building a house together. And that message has to be very clear. I don't understand couples that have separate bank accounts. I don't understand how that works. I mean, we're building our lives together. So, what does it mean? I don't get it. I don't understand it. We're building our life together. So, let's say right now she's making all the money. So what does that mean? He has to ask her for permission to buy a loaf of bread? I don't get that. I don't know. I think that the idea, the way a house is supposed to work, is that there's a mutual bank account and we build our home together. Things should be on both our names if we're building a life together. So we're building a life together. If we're not building a life together, so let's be friends. We'll wave. We'll email one another, but we won't get married. If we're getting married, then we're building a home together. Now, this is my viewpoint on things. You're welcome to ask someone else. I'm sure you'll hear a different opinion. This is my viewpoint. Little timid old me. That's what I think. I think that if a couple gets married, it means that they're ready to put their eggs in one basket, to put their finances together and build their lives together. And unfortunately, I'm seeing more and more couples that are not doing that. And I think it's reflective of the attitude with which they're entering marriage. That they're entering marriage with one foot on the diving board. Let's see if this works. You can't enter marriage with let's see if this works. If we're getting married, then we're going to make it work. If you're ready to make it work, get married. You're not ready to make it work, don't get married. email one another, wave from the window, don't even date, don't bother, there's no point. When you're ready to jump off the diving board, then start dating. If you're not ready to jump off the diving board, if you're not ready to put your all into marriage and make it work, then don't go dating. There's nothing to talk about. This is my opinion. You're welcome to talk to someone else. I'm not saying everyone's going to say what I'm saying, but this is my humble opinion. Now, once we're discussing the issue of money, so there's a common male error. Especially if the man is earning much of the money, so men like to feel like, I'm taking care of the little old lady, or I'm taking care of my cherished, darling, wonderful wife. So they're making the money, and they're paying the bills. And even if she's paying the bills, they're not too keen on showing her how to access the bank account online. What'll happen when she sees that I bought myself a new laptop in the office, but when she spent two shekel on a new pair of stockings, I said, well, I thought we're saving money this month. So I don't want her to see what I do. So there's this male tendency not to give the wife too much access to what's happening in the bank account. Even if I let her pay the bills, she doesn't really know what's happening in the bank account. Now, this backfires in a big way. There's a female tendency that matches that male tendency. That what happens is, the woman gets the feeling, okay, I understand the division of tasks. You make the money, I spend the money. So I'll do my part, now you just got to keep up with your part. And then what happens is that she's getting used to the idea that I don't have to know what's going on in the bank. I don't know how much money we have. I know, my job is to spend the money. I got to buy the food for Shabbos. I got to pay the bills. Well, okay, so here and there, I'll buy myself a new sheitel for $2,000. Come on, my role is to spend, I'll spend. Now you just got to cover it. Now this is a thing that's backfired to many, many couples in their face. I'm a big believer in that we both have to know what's going on in the bank account. And if we don't both know, then the one who's making the money shouldn't know. The one who's spending, who's in charge of the bills, should also know what's going on in the budget. Meaning if she's going to be the one paying the electric bills, doing the shopping, and ideally I think both spouses should know what's going on in the bank account. In today's day and age, it's very easy. And it's important for a couple also to make a chart. What are we making a month? And what are we spending? In the first few months of your marriage, you should try to save every receipt, keep a tally of what your expenses are, and then you'll see how much am I making, how much am I spending. And then you'll gauge yourself. Part of the first few years, especially the first year of marriage, are spent discussing how much do we spend on Shabbos. But I think it's important to have mutual responsibility. And when a couple doesn't do that, I think very often it backfires. Either separate bank accounts or all kinds of divisions, which at the end, what am I saying when I say that? I'm basically saying I'm keeping one foot out. I'm jumping off the diving board, but I want to leave one foot on. Within this concept of the faith, I believe we will continue, and the message that a person keeps has to be a very obvious and consistent message that we are married and this is forever. There's the antithesis of that, which is within a row, does happen sometimes in the best of families. So one side says, so do you want to get? Is that what you want? You want this to divorce? Now that is the worst thing you could ever do. A get, divorce, is a word that should never, ever, ever be mentioned in a home. Unfortunately, I've seen more than one instance where it was mentioned without the intent that it should get there, and before they knew it, they were there. I know of more than one instance that way, where one of the spouses said, is that what you want? And they raised the issue, and before they knew it, they were divorced. And they never wanted to get divorced. That wasn't their intent at all. In America, there's a rule when it comes to firearms, you don't threaten with a gun. You take out a gun when you're ready to shoot. Because all too often, a person would take out a gun to threaten with it, and the burglar or whoever it was would see that the guy wasn't really ready to shoot. And before they knew it, he'd have the gun, and he was using it against the guy. So in America, the rule is you don't take out a gun until you're ready to shoot. You don't threaten with a gun. The same thing is true with divorce. Divorce is not a threat. It's not a bargaining chip. It's not something to be discussed. God forbid, if it ever has to happen, it happens on its own. It's not something to be discussed. In the worst argument, you're making it 10 times worse by making this point. I know a couple that had many children. They had already married off children. And one of the spouses in an argument mentioned it. And he found, that spouse found themselves divorced 3 years later, because after they mentioned it, they hurt the other side so badly that the other side just couldn't swallow it. And 3 years it festered inside them, and then it burst. Let me just finish. And this pertains to jokes as well. Never make a joke about it. And this is the one time when I think a spouse is supposed to get upset. If the wife makes a joke about divorce or something like that, I think the husband should stop and say in a very serious tone, do me a favor, this is the most precious thing I have in my life, our marriage. I don't want to ever hear a joke about divorce. Never. And the stronger you express that, what are you telling your wife? You're telling her, my marriage to you is the most precious thing in the world. Don't even joke about us absolving it. And this is the one time when I think a husband should be stern and should be very serious to the point of anger to insist that jokes about this or any mention of this should not be in a house. And this is, if there's one message from everything we discussed today that I want you to remember and should be etched in your hearts, it's this. Everything else I think is important, but this is critical. This I unfortunately know of. I could think of a fourth case which is getting divorced now as we speak. They're in the divorce procedures now, and that's a case which also it's the fourth case in about 3 years where it's hitting divorce, where it didn't necessarily have to get there, and one side really doesn't want it, and I'm not sure if the other side wants it, but you know what, when you start talking in a certain direction, before you know it, you find yourself there. So this isn't something to joke about, quite the contrary. We want to build, and we want to ensure that it's very clear that the marriage is forever. Yeah, Matthew.
Yeah, so you said that going through storms together can make your relationship stronger. Do you think it's healthy to have arguments in a marriage relationship?
It's impossible not to have arguments. But there's a way to have an argument.
Yeah. You hear about relationships where like they never argue.
Then they're not married. No such thing. No such thing. No marriage can exist without argument. But there's a way to have an argument. Meaning there's mutual respect within an argument. There's Zat Hashem. If you want, in the next class we could learn what Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote about it. Because when his wife passed away, he declared, I never did anything wrong to her. I have nothing to apologize about. So someone later asked him, you mean you guys never argued? So he said, what do you mean? We were married. Of course we argued, but there's a way to argue. There's a way to argue that I have nothing to apologize for after the argument. And that's the way a giant in Torah argues. Even when he argues with his wife, so then a person like Rav Shlomo Zalman can say, when his wife passed away, I have nothing to apologize about. There's nothing wrong with arguing. There's nothing wrong with disagreeing strongly. And the greatest rabbis had strong arguments with their wives. But that doesn't mean that you wrong one another in an argument. But why should we agree? If we're going to move forward in life, we have to disagree. Look, there are people who don't argue. They're living two separate lives. There are such marriages. They're not really married. A fictitious marriage. Yeah.
I have a question though. Like, there are marriages when the husband and wife maybe like a couple times a decade, but in that instance, it's like a ferocious thing. Like, what's the way to? I mean, what's the better off version of that? Like, to only fight when it's like life and death.
And why do you have to? You could argue you don't have to fight.
No, but like, boys get along unless it's like the absolute bottom line. And then, like, is it better to? I don't know. Like, what's better than that?
Why don't you see if after the next few classes you have a better picture? I don't think we'll deal with that directly. We'll deal with other things, and maybe after a few more classes you'll have a picture. If you don't, bring it up again, and we'll try to deal with that specifically.